stretching then, Tim, or was that a question?
Thank you, Adam. Very, very interesting stuff. I wonder if you'd like to speculate or use evidence, whichever you are able to do, on the reason why so many tests and tests and
Yeah, you know what, I had a slide in here which actually went through some of the ideas about why, some of the drivers, we call them drivers, about why there's overutilisation. There's a whole number of drivers for overutilisation, and linked to the system, but it relates patient-related, doctor-related. A lot of it has to do with essentially the evidence and the uncertainty based within the evidence. Now, a lot of the services that came onto the Medicare benefit schedule, for example, were introduced 10 or 15 years ago when there was actually quite a poor evidence base for them. But we thought they were a good idea, and they looked good, and they were introduced onto the Medicare benefit schedule. Since then, evidence has developed, which has actually called them into question. So we found that reversing that decision has been incredibly difficult, and they've now diffused within society. The vitamin D example out of Canada, for example, the reason we looked back and thought, well, what led to this huge increase? One of the major pushes for the rise in vitamin D was really twofold. One, that there was a push that there might have been a lack of testing, so under-testing in the population. So there was a bit of a campaign to increase testing. And in Canada, what they did was they put a little box on the GP's desktop ordering software where they could just tick the box, and they were ticking the box without really thinking too much about it. So one of the things to get the number down was to take that box away. So you could still go in from a drop-down menu and select it and select the test, but it just wasn't there and visible. And a simple measure like that actually brought the test down. Another reason that that happens is that we find that within the clinical community, there's actually, it's been labelled that there is a fear of omission overrides a fear of commission. So sometimes doctors will fear not doing something and therefore not treating their patient appropriately, more than they'll fear over-treating their patient. So the trade-off there is sometimes you can over-treat and it's benign and it has no effect, but sometimes you can over-treat and it actually causes patient harm and it wastes resources. And that's actually a very valid point, and that's why I point out it's grey zone, because this talk about this grey zone, that we don't really know when that exact tipping point is to where something is appropriate, when it's inappropriate, and much more research has to be done on that. And I'll just finish by saying that Dean Scott and I published a paper in the Internal Medicine Journal, which actually went through and described all of the drivers for why we think it happens and how we can. And I can certainly add that if anybody's interested. It's a wonderful question, and the answer is that this is really just an now burgeoning area. We're just getting onto the wave of all of that work, to the point that in the United States they've just established a patient-centered outcomes research institute just 2 years ago, which is heavily funded now to ask exactly the questions that you've just raised, because there is a distinct recognition that there is a complete detachment between what patients might want in terms of their care and how that's being communicated with their clinical community.
Just looking at that chart, I must say, just to reflect on that, where the UK does extraordinarily well. In the UK, play NHS bashing as a kind of national sport. You know, it used to be just behind soccer, and now it's probably in front of soccer, given the last month. So there's a sort of dissonance between what people feel about, you know, what you hear about the NHS, but in fact what then people report when they do surveys like this is...
Absolutely. You're quite right. And in fact, I really recommend the Commonwealth Fund website. All of these slides are available, and one of them is actually around... I was, again, going to include it, but there's only so many slides you can include. One of them was they asked, are you happy with your healthcare system? Do you think it needs minor reform or completely overhauled? And it's surprising that nobody in any country really likes the healthcare system, funnily enough. There's no real rhyme or reason around, you know, you would think that some of these would translate nicely to those graphs, and they do vaguely, but not very well. But the UK, in that, always comes out the best as well.
Right.
So it seems to be a sport, as you say, but actually when you get down to the meat of it, I think most people are very happy with the NHS.
It's very hard to understand a long way of walking in the UK. How come we become number one in the world and only 10th in terms of long term doctor's lives?
Yeah, we have to look at the methodology for how they're determining that.
Or it may be linked to the performance of the English soccer team. All right, one more question. Who's not asked a question so far? Right at the very back, Heather.
Well, thank you for a very stimulating presentation. It you know, triggered off a whole heap of different thoughts. And from the Public Health Association perspective, I'm just trying to grapple with, well, yes, there are perhaps inefficiencies or inappropriate use of money within the healthcare system, but if we're talking about health, how can we also think about these discussions? Well, if we're making savings or managing the expenditure in the healthcare system, how can we redirect that to more population health or you know, education expenditures and so on, which will have a positive health outcome? And it's a bit of the semantics, I suppose, which I've touched on for the title of my little presentation this afternoon, in that, you know, we indispose health with healthcare,
right,
and health reform and healthcare reform without actually having that discussion. And some of these figures and so on would really help in what Catherine King mentioned this morning about, well, what is it that we really value? Let's have that discussion with our communities about, is it health, is it absence of disease, is it access to services when we need them? What is it that we're really valuing as a society, and how can we work our expenditures so that one area doesn't blow out because we think health is healthcare and access to healthcare, when in fact, really as a society, we're looking much more at individual health on a day-to-day basis or the health of our children going forward or whatever it might be.
I couldn't agree more. And that's why I was so enthusiastic about including this slide. And as I said, we could have talked about this slide for the entire 20 minutes, in my opinion, because you're quite right. I would include all of these things within the same envelope as healthcare. It just so happens that I'm only one person and I focus in, you know, healthcare has been, a fascinating area for me to demonstrate the principles of efficiency, cost effectiveness and appropriateness and patient-centred care. But all of those debates could be equally expanded to all of the elements of present on this chart, I think so, yeah. And I think as an academic and research community, we probably haven't been as good as we could have been over the years at demonstrating the value proposition of all of these other multi-sectoral elements for their contribution to health. Yeah, so...
All right, would you